you are. From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Up-and-coming Chinese entrepreneurs have been adopting the mantra of Silicon Valley. Technology will change the world. But will technology change China? By 2006, China is predicted to have more internet users than the United States or any other country in the world. In his new book, China Dawn, David Sheff says that it's the internet that will turn China from its oppressive legacy of Communist Party rule to a more open, more powerful society. But while internet visionaries are building the infrastructure to network China with the world, Chinese party bureaucrats still largely control the information flow. Will technology democratize China, or will it be just another tool for the government in Beijing to maintain control of the country? Does an internet boom mean more to China than it has to the United States? And what will a wired China mean for the world? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from San Francisco is David Sheff. He's author of China Dawn, The Story of a Technology and Business Revolution. Good evening and welcome, David Sheff.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. David Sheff, why is the web especially significant for China? There's an awful lot of jaundice in the United States now about the internet and everything it stands for, everything it touches or touched. But you tell a very revved up story of anticipation, great expectation in China around the internet. Why?
Well, it's because of where these people are coming from. We are sort of jaded. We've heard so many times that whatever the new technology of the moment is going to change our lives. All the CEOs are always telling us that they're bringing in a revolution. The difference is that in China, the idea of free exchange of information, free communication, the kinds of things that we absolutely take for granted are unknown in China. So the fact that there are kids in Beijing communicating with kids in some of the villages, and they're writing their friends in New York, they're reading mail, they're getting email, they're reading international websites. It's mind blowing. There's such a sense of excitement and of possibility when you're with these people in China that
even as you say that, David Sheff, I'm not sure that Americans can completely get their heads around easily the level of that excitement. We log on the internet in our sleep. We read the news wires. We read the chat rooms. We read everything, and we take it as just that's the texture of our lives. What's the head snapping aspect of that in a Chinese context?
The fact, as one of the guys who I hung out with says, to go from no exchange at all, to such a vibrant exchange is what is transforming things, and it's what is sort of pushing these people forward. The idea that when there's an international incident, whether it's the terrorist attacks of September 11th or whether it's something more personal to China, such as the embassy bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, those kinds of things. It's the first time that the Chinese people, first of all, know what's going on, and second of all, that they're able to participate in the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Right there. David Sheff, give us a baseline understanding of the web's presence in China today. What percentage of people in China are on the internet, and how free is their access?
Well, there are 35 million people online in China now, which sounds like a lot, especially when you hear that that number is doubling every 6 to 9 months. But we're talking about a country with 1.3 billion people, so the penetration is very small. The question of its growth is extraordinary because the projections are such that about 800 million people have television sets in China. And since some of the new technology that's being put in place will bring TV over cable that are connecting TVs and that are people are going to have access in a lot of different ways. That there are places where people without telephones in their homes will have access to the web. In the meantime, there are 300,000 websites. They range everything from the kinds of things that we see here and we take for granted. Pornography is illegal in China, but of course it's online.
Can I stop you just for a second? There are 300,000 websites. What do you mean by that? Does that mean Chinese users of the web don't have access to all the websites in the world?
No, there are 300,000 of their own websites. In other words, people have put up websites in China. But no, they do have access, although they don't have free access. And that's a big part of this story. The government has a love-hate relationship with the internet and other technologies in China. It needs the internet. It wants the state-of-the-art internet because it wants China to be a competitor second to none in this new global economy. At the same time, the internet is a threat. The Chinese government, the Communist Party, has maintained its control by controlling, in part, by controlling information and by controlling many, many aspects of life in China. Technology does not allow that, or at least it begins to drive a wedge in that control.
We want to talk about what the political ramifications will be, but I guess I just want to be very attuned to American listeners who may still be struggling with a sense of cynicism about the web. The bust has been so fabled here in the United States. I guess maybe this way would do it. What do you foresee as the ultimate impact of the internet on Chinese politics, Chinese society, Chinese economy?
Well, the range is, I don't even know where to start.
Give us a sense of scale. How big a deal is it going to be?
Well, here's an example of how things have changed, and I think this is something that we all can relate to. There was an explosion at a school in a small town in China.
I seem to remember this.
In the newspaper, it said the next day that it was because the children in this school, 8 and 9 year old kids, were being forced to install detonators in firecrackers. Mm-hmm. The teachers were selling the firecrackers. It was a way to supplement their income. The next day, the government said it never happened. They said that there was an explosion. It was caused by a deranged person. That day, all of the press, all the media in China, including the internet sites, wiped out the story. The story was gone. But there were some internet sites that didn't listen to the party line. They didn't play the game. They sent out reporters. They talked to victims. They talked to families. They talked to teachers. The story didn't die. That is something that's never happened before in China. And then the next thing that happened was the most extraordinary thing of all. The premier of China came out on television and said that the government had made a mistake, that the government bears unshirkable responsibility for this explosion, and he said that there would now be an investigation. That's the kind of thing that we do take for granted. If something like that happened here, of course there'd be an investigation. The New York Times, every newspaper, reported. Anyway,
in China.
Unthinkable. Mm-hmm. It's unthinkable. That's the kind of thing that.
So what are you suggesting there? Give us your big tent poles. Are you saying, therefore, do we take away from that internet in China equals democracy? Are you saying this will be the way that democracy is introduced to China? And what are you saying socially? What are you saying economically? Give us the kind of scale of impact you're projecting.
Yeah, they're all good questions, and some of it is unanswerable because there's so many factors. When you're talking about China, you're talking about it's such a complex place. But I will say, there are people who say that the internet equals democracy in China. I don't know about that, at least not in the short term. Part of it is because, when you think about it, what is the definition of a democracy is it is a representation of the people. So if the people of China, we want China to look like the United States, but imposing democracy is an oxymoron. But what the internet will do is it will help to raise the level of conversation in China. It will help Chinese people understand world events, understand their own country. It'll help them communicate among themselves. It will raise the conversation to the point that something will change radically in the long run. Will it look how much like the United States will it look? We just don't know. But it absolutely could pave the way for something as radical as a pluralistic system.
And economic impact. Where do you think that the internet and the technology surrounding it will take China economically?
Really good point that though the social implications and political implications are further off, the economic implications are around the corner. The first thing that's going to happen is that Chinese companies right now, because of the WTO, China is now part of the WTO,
World Trade Organization.
Chinese companies are going to have to, Chinese companies have to compete with the best, fastest companies in the world. In many cases, some of the biggest manufacturing companies of China, for example, are still running on fax machines and telephones and completely old-fashioned, inefficient ways of working.
The impact of the web, then?
That's right. They're going to the web They're trying to develop overnight systems that will make up for the fact that they have not had the last 10 years, or actually more than that. They haven't had the last 20 years of development of an information technology industry.
But are you projecting then a new Chinese economic powerhouse? And is the internet the thread, the highway that takes it to that new economic glory?
Ultimately, I would say yes, although it's not going to be an easy road there. There are so many factors, once again. Chinese, there are only about 300,000 or 400,000 people who live in the biggest cities and who have even middle incomes, so that they'll be affected in the short term by this technology.
Only 300,000 or 400,000 out of a billion plus?
Three or 400 million.
Million, okay.
So we're talking about, but we're still talking about what, 900 million,
mm-hmm.
maybe a billion people who are in poverty. The numbers of unemployed in China are in the millions. So we're not talking about an overnight change, but we are talking about a change. And the only way that there will be a possibility of a change is if technology arrives, it's unfettered, it's going to have impact in all kinds of different ways. Mm. Chinese scientists will be communicating with their peers. The level of research, the level of training will improve. All those kinds of things will improve. The government plans right now to wire all of its schools. So right now, in a place where there's such a high level of illiteracy, they're going to be jumping not only to at least the goal is that they'll be jumping to 100% not only literacy, but 100% computer literacy.
Your book, China Dawn, certainly thrums with enthusiasm and anticipation of all that. Tell us about, you've got a very narrative style in the book. You really tell the story through the stories of young Chinese entrepreneurs. You have personal relationships with some or all of these guys. You've been an unofficial advisor and investor in a venture capital fund that one of them, Bo Feng, co-founded. Explain all that to us. How has your closeness to the story, the people in the story, influenced how you portray China?
Well, I've been hanging out with the people who are, to use the word, thrum. that's the feeling when you're with these guys.
The people that thrum.
The people that thrum. It's as if, I guess the only analogy I can think of is if there was a journalist who happened to be friends with Steve Jobs before he pulled together that first Apple II computer with his or that Apple I computer circuit board with Steve Wozniak, and they started their company, and their friend sort of said, "Hey, this is pretty cool. Maybe there's a story in this," and followed them along. That's sort of the experience I had.
But you're not just a journalist. Unless I misunderstand, you're an investor.
That's right. My whole professional career being a journalist. This is the first time. What happened was a dear friend of ours became, believe it or not, he was 10 years ago, he was a filmmaker and a sushi chef. And in what I describe as the most improbable transformation since Jesse Ventura, my friend Bo Feng has become one of the most prominent venture capitalists funding IT companies in China. So there was a certain point, actually, Bo and I were one day on the beach with our kids, and by complete coincidence, an editor of Wired magazine, I write for Wired magazine, one of the editors walked by, sat down with us, talked to us, and looked at me and said, "Why aren't you doing this story for us?" Within a week, I was on a plane to China. That's how it happened. So it was a completely different experience for me. It was not an assignment. I didn't go in as an objective journalist. I came in. These guys, as you said, they're dear friends of mine. I'm the godfather of this man's child. I became good friends with some of these other people. I advised some of their companies. At the same time, I realized, you know, what I do without what I do both for a living and also just it's my passion. I can't help but do it is to write about the experiences.
But should we be suspicious of your enthusiasm? Are you hyping an investment, David Sheff?
You could be suspicious of it, but I think that the important thing is that you know that I'm an investor. You know that I'm friends of these people, but I will also tell you that I'm a journalist first. If there was a good story, if I watched these guys fail in some fabulous way, it is in the book.
There's no question. We feel the journalist in the book, and we feel your enthusiasm for the story, but we wanted all the cards right out there on the table. We're talking with author David Sheff about his new book, China Dawn, about the internet and high technology in China, raising the possibility that this is the true great leap forward for the Middle Kingdom. What do you think? What will the evolution of the internet mean for China? for the world. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with author, journalist David Sheff about his new book, China Dawn, The Story of a Technology and Business Revolution. David Sheff has looked into what's happening with the Internet in China, really a kind of bicoastal view from California and from the coast of China on the other side of the Pacific. And he's come out of it with a tremendous enthusiasm. For what's afoot, he says, Americans can hardly understand the scale and implications of what's going on with the Internet, with technology in China. We may feel jaundiced after the boom, the bubble, and the bust in the United States. David Sheff says, shake it off. It's happening in China in a different way. So the question is, can a technology reshape a society? And for China, might web evolution mean revolution? What will a fully wired China mean for the world? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Arvind is on the line. Welcome, Arvind. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Good evening. Basically, the question was regarding how do you think the Internet will affect not the societies which have the connection right now, not the rich ones and so on, but more like the huge number of Chinese and even the Indians who are, the agricultural laborers and so on, who do not quite own huge tracts of land to farm, but they're really the ones who do not even have access to very good education, and then you suddenly throw in this Internet thing, which is this, you get time to get used to it. And how is this going to affect, the lower sections of the society? Lower, economically as well as educationally.
It's a great question, Arvind. The other billion, the billion in China that don't have anything like Internet access. And your Arvind's question really goes to India as well. But let's look at China, David Sheff. What about that? We know how China is divided between its industrialized, its commercially super active coastal areas and an interior that can look positively medieval. What's the significance of the Internet there for those people?
It's an enormous question. And one of the things I can say is that the people who are doing this work think about this question a lot. So, for instance, Edward Tian, the man I write about, who is the head now of China Netcom, one of his passions, one of his goals is to make sure that isn't forgotten. And so he's doing things like wiring schools, wiring village centers, things like that.
Is this going to actually tear China apart? Will it exaggerate the difference between the coast and the interior, between rich or well-off and
Edward,
poor?
I asked Edward about this question. The digital divide is big in the United States, but the potential for a Western-style digital divide in China is just so much bigger. He says that in some ways that's absolutely true, and of course they have to watch for it. But on the other hand, because first of all, there is so little infrastructure that has to be replaced. Places that have no infrastructure at all can instantly be wired with the latest technology. But on the other hand, the vision partly is that there will be a slow evolutionary impact for the rest of the nation, and that is because the Internet will provide, for instance, new economy-style jobs. It will improve schools. It will allow the mass. Right now, there's an exodus from Chinese farms, from villages around China to the big cities, as China is changing, and so the unemployment rate is enormous. Mm. So, better run companies, better competitors. In other words, the wiring, for instance, of the manufacturing, the enormous manufacturing companies of China, making those compete better, will all help with the big social problems. It's not a matter – there's nobody that thinks that these people in villages are going to be sending email and buying stuff on Amazon. That's not what the vision is about. It's about a slow evolution, technology helping to transform a nation slowly.
We're talking with David Sheff about his new book, China Dawn. You can join the conversation. Post-U.S. boom, post-U.S. bubble, will the web mean more to China than it has to the West? I want to ask also, I guess, to our listeners, might the web or will the web mean the end of China's Communist Party at some point? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. David Jeff, stand by for just a second, if you will. I want to welcome into our conversation Ethan Guttman. He's a visiting fellow at the Project for the New American Century. He's worked as a government relations and business consultant in Beijing. Good evening and welcome, Ethan Guttman.
Good evening. How are you?
Real well. Thanks for being with us. Ethan, I don't know if you've read David Jeff's book yet, China Dawn.
I just picked it up yesterday. And I've skimmed through it. I haven't read the whole thing.
Well, you must know, because the word is out. This is a very optimistic and excited view of what the Internet does mean already for China. Do you share this enthusiasm, this excitement?
Well, I do to some extent. I mean, I think me and Chef are on the same page in a feeling that the Internet is the best chance the Chinese people have ever been given in some ways to build a democracy. But at the same time, I feel that some of this enthusiasm or the moral glamour that's kind of associated with some of these Chinese entrepreneurs has created kind of a cover for the Chinese government and their crackdown on the Internet, which has become very severe over the last year.
What do you mean by a cover? Our eye is drawn to the glamorous stories and not to the crackdown?
That's right. And at the same time, it's also created a kind of a cover or a rationalization for U.S. businesses, which have played a direct role in building a Chinese Internet, which is rapidly becoming a tool of surveillance. And the Great Firewall, as it's often called.
So you're saying U.S. companies have profited from helping the Chinese government make the Internet less free in China?
Sadly enough, yes, they have. And they've often made decisions which, we don't expect U.S. businesses to go out and free dissidents or get people out of jail. But we do expect them to sort of take a first of all, do no harm approach. And in several cases, the Chinese government has come and said, if you want access to the market, you can get it, but you have to do X. In the case of Cisco, for example, it was, do something you've never done in any other country. Build a special firewall box, which then you will, now 80% of the routers in China are Cisco routers. And they have established a fairly sophisticated firewall that's making it very difficult for the kind of people we were just discussing, especially people who are first getting on the Internet, to get out.
David Jeff, come in here and describe for us, if you will, the Great Firewall, as Ethan Guttman puts it. What is the technology and extent of Chinese government intervention and control of the Internet in China? How exactly does it work in non-technical terms as much as you can?
Well, it's Orville Schell, the great China scholar, says that he describes it as a horse race and which side will win. There are forces in the government. Some I've heard figures from everywhere from 30,000 to 300,000 people employed, engineers that are their job is to control the internet, to watch the email and to make sure that dissident sites are removed from the web. There have been arrests. I think there are as many as 30 people in jail now for crimes using the internet.
I wanted to ask if as an American I was in China and I got on the internet, would it feel like a different experience to me? Would it feel somehow cramped, constrained, confined, or would it feel like just jumping on in Los Angeles or New York?
It's not like jumping on in Los Angeles, New York, although I've had different experiences, different times in different places throughout China. There are times when I've been had easy access to almost any website I've wanted to get to, whether it's Western news, CNN, The Times.
Can I go to Google and punch in the name of a Chinese dissident and pull up all the sites that relate to that dissident, or would that be blocked?
Sometimes it's blocked. Often it's blocked. The government, as Mr. Guttman has pointed out, the government is very sophisticated, and they're getting more sophisticated. The technology entrepreneurs who are building this up are aware of it. They talk about it. They're concerned about it. There's a difference between a lot of these young people who are doing this work now because they were educated in the United States, and so they went back to China because they really had a sense of a mission. It's not easy. The forces are huge. you know, Mr. Gutman's piece that he recently wrote, where he was describing this, was just an eye-opening article for me. A whole new way to think about it. I'm really interested in going back to talk to some of these people about the role of companies like Cisco and which are making a killing and will continue to make a killing in China.
We're talking about China, about technology, the internet in particular, and what it may mean for the future of that country politically, socially, economically. What will the evolution of the internet mean for China? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Louise is on the line. Welcome, Louise. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Yeah, I'm very concerned because China is a police state, and right now it's engaged in a very severe persecution of anyone and everyone who practices Falun Gong.
Falun Gong, the religious and
Qigong cultivation practice. Mm-hmm. People practice truthfulness, compassion, and tolerance.
What do you know about this? What you describe as persecution of Falun Gong on the internet, Louise?
Well, websites have been blocked, and it's a kind of information warfare that China's engaged in to slander the practice and to block any other information. So, for example, Westerners have been going to Tiananmen Square for the past couple months to appeal to end the persecution and break through this information blockade. And most recently in Changchun, China, some very brave practitioners spliced some cable television cables to broadcast for 40 to 50 minutes to break through some of the lies that the government has spread about the Falun Gong practice.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, the Jiang Zemin regime issued a shoot-to-kill order to shoot anybody seen posting a flyer. And they're rounding up people in Changchun, rounding up practitioners. It's been reported that up to 5,000 people have been arrested.
Louise, we got it, and we thank you for your call. I want to put this to Ethan Gutman. Here's the voice of opposition, political dissent in China, in this case Falun Gong, which seems to pop up everywhere whenever China is discussed. And Louise reminds us, this is a state that is fully prepared to come down very hard on any stripe of dissent. David Sheff describes this, quoting Orville Schell, as a horse race between the use of the internet for I guess, free thinking and free business on the one hand, and the government and its police state instincts on the other. Ethan Gutman, who do you think's winning the race right now in China? Is the internet more a tool for opening up China or a tool for observing and clamping down?
Well, I think the listener's question was very good, because I remember that moment distinctly when the Falun Gong crackdown started and they started talking about Falun Gong on Chinese TV.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a Beijing TV studio. Sound trucks appeared outside of the studio broadcasting messages saying, do not practice Falun Gong. Falun Gong is now illegal. It was quite unreal. It was like a throwback to the Cultural Revolution.
What role does the internet play in that war, if you will?
Well, it was the main lifeline for Falun Gong, as it is for many underground Christians. It was a way for them to communicate with the larger world. What's happened, and it's been described very well by certain reporters who kind of followed this, is that they have to, have like three or four hard drives in many cases to communicate with each other. So you are playing cat and mouse on the web, and a tremendous amount of Falun Gong practitioners have been arrested, and I believe we don't know how many it's directly based on the internet, but a lot of them are. We're seeing more and more signs of this. One of the reasons is because of these various Western companies, Nortel, Cisco, and others, have come in with surveillance technology, which they've handed over part and parcel to the Public Security Bureau in China, the Ministry of State Security.
David Schiff, give us your view on that, on the role of American companies, I guess in part, as Ethan Gutman describes, perhaps handing over the technology that China needs or wants to turn the web into a surveillance tool, but also in terms of empowering the Chinese high-tech industry. Are American companies a major factor in your mind?
Well, I have always maintained that technology is neutral. So how are we going to use it? But now I think what Mr.
Gutman's
pointing
out. Reconsidering a little bit.
Yeah, I am reconsidering. I mean, the idea that there's a guy who works out of Washington D.C. and he sends in a newsletter into China once a week. Somebody described all the news that Beijing deems unfit to print. He blasted into email addresses all over China. He said, he points out, how can the government check? It's one thing if there were 10,000, if there were 100,000, if there were maybe even a million email messages a day. But when the numbers go 50 million, that's 100 million email. But, maybe that's naive. Maybe it will be possible that technology will be used to trace senders of what the government considers subversive material.
Ethan Guttman, what's your sense? Your article in the Weekly Standard has a lot of people thinking about just that. Will the horse race go to freedom and democracy or to surveillance?
I think it depends partly on what we do. The forces right now on the other side, Nortel in particular, has really stood out. They've come over to China. They're offering the state-of-the-art technology and surveillance stuff that can basically take a video image, do facial recognition, voice recognition, tie that up to the person on the Internet, their surfing history, explore the corners of the Internet, not just the international gateways. At the same time, there's the cult of the dead cow. There's the various hacktivists out there. There's Triangle Boy and Safe Web. These are all groups, right?
The cult of the dead cow. What is that?
It's a sort of hacktivist group. They're kind of international group which promotes internet freedom. And a lot of these groups are organic. They've grown up not just around China, but around a lot of other societies where this issue is really important.
Ethan Guttman, stand by. I want to get a quick call before the break. Lily's on the line. Welcome, Lily. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. This is. I just tried to say a little bit about my experience back there.
In China?
Yes. I'm Chinese, and I went back for a visit last year, between July and December. And I was using the Internet to email my husband every day. Mm-hmm. And I also use it to call, use the Internet phone.
Any problem? Any interference, Lily, or was it easy?
No, there's no. I mean, the problem was sometimes, there's trouble with the phone line, because some cable was broken off for a day or two, that's all. And I was just using Yahoo as I use it here. And I send the digital pictures over. To my husband, we email every day, and also I use the internet phone to call here. I feel that it's amazing that there are so many, they call it internet bar there.
Internet bars, yeah.
Yeah, and I feel it's really booming, and people are getting access to it.
It's a good reality check. Lily, thanks for your call. David Sheff, Lily says, hey, I was back in China. I used it no problem, just like at home, and it felt good to me.
That's right, but if she was trying to get information about Falun Gong or about any of the dissidents who are in jail, it's less likely that she would have had that same experience.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with David Sheff. He's author of China Dawn, The Story of a Technology and Business Revolution. And with Ethan Guttman, he's a visiting fellow at the Project for the New American Century. He's just had a recent article in the Weekly Standard on U.S. companies providing technology to help the Chinese government use the Internet for surveillance. What do you think? Will the web mean the end of China's Communist Party, ultimately? Will the web set China's masses free? Or are we smoking something here? Are we drinking the Chinese Kool-Aid? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about China and the Internet and asking whether a technology can reshape a society, whether for China, web evolution may mean a new revolution. Our guests are David Sheff, author of China Dawn, The Story of a Technology and Business Revolution, and Ethan Guttman, a visiting fellow at the Project for the New American Century in Washington. You're welcome to join us as well. What will the evolution of the Internet mean for China? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bob is on the line. Welcome, Bob. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
It occurs to me that perhaps the Chinese might realize that they don't need total control of the Internet, but merely dominance. And one thing that I read last year makes me realize that getting dominance of the Internet is not as difficult as it might seem.
You mean national, within the boundaries of China, Bob?
Right. For example, on the Internet as a whole, especially, primarily the U.S., but it includes, there are four companies that control websites that represent over half of the page accesses on the Internet today. So the four companies dominate today's internet worldwide. It, for political control, it may not be necessary to have total control. I realize we got it.
So that goes back to the issue of technological control. But David Schiff, we've touched on that a bit. Take us to the other side of it. How do you see the internet working in terms of more pluralism, more diversity of opinion and communication in China?
Well, you know, it's first of all, the internet's not working in a vacuum. There are so many other forces. The Chinese economy is an enormous force. If things don't improve in the economy, if the unemployment rate continues to rise, if the country feels more unstable than stable because of a lot of economic and other issues, then it doesn't matter if most people are using the internet for benign purposes, for commerce, for the kinds of things that the government would like it to use it for. It is and will remain a force to do things that are have never been able to be done before in China before, to organize on a mass level, to communicate. So if there will be some groundswell of opposition to the government, that's where it will likely come from.
Mm-hmm. Bob, thanks for your call. David Schiff, give us a sense, because we haven't really let you have your moment with it, of this entrepreneurial culture that has burgeoned in China. We got a big dose of it in the United States in the 90s, and people have left that decade with all kinds of mixed feelings about it. But we don't want to assume that it's a copycat experience in China. You describe these entrepreneurs living with one foot in California, the other foot in China's coast, and living the very headiest sort of internet high ride. What's it all about?
Yeah, these guys are... I've spent a lot of time in the Silicon Valley in California, and in fact in Route 128 in Massachusetts, and people work hard there. Everybody knows that. But these guys in China work harder. There's an urgency to their lives and to their work that is impressive, and it's infectious. And if I do sound exuberant, it is because of being with them, and it is being sort of in the trenches with them and feeling that. It's a very small and elite group. They don't represent the masses of Chinese people, but they do have, as I said before, because mostly of it's because of an influence of American and their educations here, but also their families. I've met a lot of their families, and their families are socially concerned. Many of them are teachers, and many of them are teachers and writers and philosophers, and they come from backgrounds, and they suffered greatly during the Cultural Revolution.
Are they rich? Are they role models? Are they in the Chinese media as heroes of a new age?
Some of them are. Some of these guys are. But one of the interesting things that's happening is that I've heard this a lot. When these men were young, they had no role models. There was no such thing as anyone to look up to inspire them. But now they are the role models, and there are young Chinese who are. I met some guy who was he was describing in a way that was very emotional. How his family, for every generation, has been a family of peasants, and here, because of the internet, he was able to find out about a program that brought him to a great school in a big city, and now he's got a job in the IT world. And it is, it's one example of 1.3 billion people. So it's going to take a while, but
he's off
dramatic.
To the races, though. Ethan Gutman, are these guys headed for the same fall that so many web entrepreneurs in the States met with?
Well, I don't really believe the new economy has really taken off in China as much as all that. But I do share Mr. Schiff's enthusiasm to a certain extent. I mean, I remember a peasant boy tugging in my sleeve at a function, asking me in broken English if I was a venture capitalist.
Wow.
And after that, I decided...
Come on. Are you serious?
I decided I needed to lose some weight after that. But... You know, frankly, it's the problem here is just that there's a rhetoric of freedom and free enterprise, but all these entrepreneurs have to make a tremendous amount of deals with the government constantly. They're constantly being watched, and I mean, Chef outlines that a lot in the book. At the same time, there's a lot of promotion of self-censorship that goes along with this.
Is there a different economic fate awaiting these entrepreneurs from the many American web entrepreneurs who saw their structures, their fortunes vanish?
Well, I think the ministries up till now, the Chinese, the answer to that, I think, is the Chinese ministries up till now have been in kind of a warring states period. But the internet industry has taken off enough that they are now beginning to cut into the profits of these things. In other words, they're assuming ownership of it. Each ministry has started to assume ownership of a major part of the internet.
And that is not a positive sign in your view?
Not really, no.
Kui Lam is on the air. Welcome, Kui Lam.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Being a Chinese, I would like to say that still there is a certain gap between how Westerners view the current situation in China mm-hmm. from how Chinese view it. For example, the gentleman said it is still unacceptable from Western point of view, mm-hmm. but being a former government official myself and also graduate from Beijing University myself.
Okay, Beida.
Yes, exactly. And also, I come from a peasant family background.
So what's your view, Kui Lam? How do you think the internet is affecting China? And do you think it's a threat to the government there or not?
I do not necessarily think it is a threat. However, it is going to take the government time to respond to such a new occurrence.
And are you or were you, Kui Lam, part of the Communist Party?
No, I was not.
Do you think that the party members who still have enormous sway in China feel threatened by the internet?
Certainly. I think it is related to the mindset, basically. Mm-hmm. From my perspective, I've been here for 6 years, mm-hmm. but when I talk with my family member, sometimes I can feel that I look at things from a more liberate point of view, mm-hmm. and gradually my family members are also being influenced by me, like in making family decisions, etc. So I see that over a period of time, when people gradually know what freedom means, what democracy means mm-hmm. to their everyday life, mm-hmm. it will be like ice being broken down or being melted.
And we know what happens then. Kui Lam, thanks very much for your call. Ethan Gutman, we're coming to the end of our time, but your final thoughts in 20, 30 seconds on where the internet is and is not taking China.
Well, my fear is that this is ending up sort of like, the Hollywood movie The Matrix, that it's something where it appears to be free. You appear to have this whole free world, but in fact it's not. And I really would like to see, my goal is to see the administration really make internet freedom a priority in China.
And David Sheff, where is the web taking this great big country, biggest in the world, and where is it not?
Well, I agree that there are a lot of risks and there are a lot of pitfalls, but as Mr. Gutman points out in his piece, it's the best hope that we have, and it's the best hope that the Chinese people have.
David Sheff, author of China Dawn, The Story of a Technology and Business Revolution, thanks very much for being with us tonight. And Ethan Gutman, visiting fellow at the Project for the New American Century, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You can read the first chapter of China Dawn on our website. The address is onpointradio.org. Earlier today, we took our microphone to a home in Auburndale, Massachusetts, as a Jewish family prepared for their Seder. In just a moment, we'll listen in. This evening, people are gathering in homes around the world to celebrate the first evening of Passover. Janet Linder lives in Auburndale, Massachusetts. We visited her this afternoon as a few members of her family prepared for a very modern Seder.
Passover is my favorite Jewish holiday because it celebrates the idea of freedom and bringing peace to the world. And it's a time to gather in all your family and friends and include everybody. You never want someone not to have a place to go on Passover. About 20 years ago, when I first moved to Boston, I didn't have any place to go for the first night of Passover. And I was at work, and a friend of mine at 4:30 in the afternoon happened to ask me what I was doing for Passover. And I said, nothing. And she said, well, you can come to my boyfriend's house, just bring a chair. So I did, and I had a wonderful time. And that's what I try to do every year. I try to include anybody who wants to come. So it's really fun to just open your door and always make room. We're having about 30 people, but I kind of stopped counting. We have two of my sisters are coming with their part of their families. And then we have some friends who come every year. One friend is from South Africa. I have another friend whose entire family lives in Israel, so she comes with her family. They have three kids. And this year I also invited my nephew, who lives in Providence, and he has a roommate who's never been to a Seder. He's Hispanic. And this morning I was at a store, and I bumped into one of my mother-in-law's best friends, and I told her she had to come to our house. And there's also a lot of little kids under the age of 10, so that makes it lively. The Seders are supposed to be centered around children, to tell them the story of Passover and explain the meaning and talk about freedom and peace and why all those things are so important. So it's fun to make it interesting and lively. It's not supposed to be serious and somber. So it gets pretty lively. Because we have such a big Seder, and I'm not the world's greatest cook, everybody brings something. So I made the brisket and some of the vegetable dishes and some of the desserts, but everybody brings something, so it really makes it special. We set out the table, everybody comes in and puts their big bowl or pan down, and everything's delicious. Seder means order, and you read a book called the Haggadah, and there's thousands of different Haggadahs, and I use one that I've put together, cut and pasted. It's kind of modern, and it really stresses the themes of freedom and equality and helping to make the world a better place, free of oppression, and I certainly think that's very important to talk about today. I also ask people to bring something to read that means something to them, either a poem or a quotation or a question on the idea, theme of peace or freedom, to add whatever personal ideas they wanted to inject, because you're supposed to kind of talk and discuss and debate things. So I thought that would be a nice thing to do rather than just read from the Haggadah. One of the Haggadahs I use at the end has part of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. So we usually ask somebody to read that, and I actually have a CD with that speech on it. So we might try to actually play part of that tonight if I can figure out how to do it, to actually hear Martin Luther King say those words, because they really apply and they're very appropriate to think about on Passover, particularly this year with so much going on in the world and the violence in the Middle East and the war in Afghanistan. It's very relevant to celebrate Passover, to really make us think about, first of all, how fortunate we are in America, and also our obligation to try to bring peace to the rest of the world. And it's especially important to let children know about that and to teach them about that, because they are the ones who will be handed the world in the next generation. So I'm hoping we can talk about how the Palestinians deserve a peaceful world just as much as the Israelis, and how we hope everybody will stop killing each other.
Janet Linder and her party of 30 are celebrating Passover tonight in Auburndale, Massachusetts. You can listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Darren Manoogian, Tim Munro, and Laura Tenguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.